From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
The bill is so sweeping and expansive that I really encourage folks to look into it and understand the many ripple effects that it has on everyone who is eating and shopping in the U.S.
Last week, an $867 billion farm bill failed to pass the U.S. House of Representatives. Back in January, Good Food aired a show all about the farm bill. Food and agriculture reporter Leah Douglas was our guide, helping us to understand this essential, though complicated, piece of legislation. Today, Leah's back to explain what's been happening in Washington since then and why we should all care. Hi, Leah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you back again. It seems like time just has really flown since we saw you. A lot has happened with the Farm Bill.
Yeah, it has been very busy.
So the House failed to pass the Farm Bill last week. Can you refresh our memory on what the basic Farm Bill process looks like when it's successful?
Sure. So every Farm Bill process starts with each the House and the Senate Agriculture Committee drafting their own version of the bill. And that's typically a pretty bipartisan process within the members of those agriculture committees. And then each agriculture committee brings their version of the bill to either the House or the Senate. And each bill must be approved by the House and the Senate. Once that happens, the two bills are reconciled, and then the new bill goes back to the House and the Senate for another vote. And once that gets all the votes it needs, then it can go to the president for a signature.
And all along that process of reconciliation, there are amendments added, correct?
Yes. So typically, there's a markup period while each of the House and Senate agriculture committees are considering the bill, and then again when the broader House and Senate are considering the bill. So that's when amendments will be brought and debate will be had on the floor about what the bill should look like.
So the House failed to pass the bill last week. Can you tell us what happened with the House version of the bill?
Sure. So the House Farm Bill has been really kind of a controversial process this year. It was very partisan in that the Republican majority in the House Agriculture Committee wrote their version of the bill and didn't show it to Democrats until really the last minute before the markup process. And typically, as I said earlier, the Farm Bill is sort of known for being a relatively bipartisan piece of policy and somewhat not as susceptible to sort of the political climate of the times. But of course, this year, it's a relatively extreme political climate on the Hill. And so the Farm Bill process reflected that more than it typically does. So the House bill ended up not having any Democratic amendments from the markup process from the Agriculture Committee because Democrats refused to participate and basically said that they thought the bill process, both the process was poorly handled, and that also the bill itself was basically didn't deserve their time, was essentially the mood during the markup. So once it went to the full House, there was already this climate of non-participation from Democrats. And Mike Conaway, the chair of the Republican chair of the House Agriculture Committee, was very confident that he had the votes to pass the bill without any Democrats. But at the last minute on the voting day, a few Republicans defected, and they ended up losing the bill vote.
So my understanding is that 30 Republicans voted against the bill, but their reasons had nothing to do with the bill?
Yeah, so there was a last-minute coalition among conservative Republicans to hold off their votes until an immigration bill had been passed, and it basically just stymied the vote process such that Republicans were unable to get all the votes they needed.
One of the things that's fascinating about the Farm Bill is one of the reasons usually it's such a bipartisan effort is that it's this mashup of both urban and rural interests that have to come together to produce this bill. And it seems like this particular version, there was a lot of controversy around two big parts of that. One, the SNAP part of the bill, which is what some people think of as food stamps. And on the other side, the subsidy program, the farm subsidy program. Could you talk about those two elements of controversy?
Sure. So SNAP was definitely the biggest controversial stumbling block for Democrats in the House Agriculture Committee. Essentially, the Republican version of the bill was introduced with expanded work requirements for SNAP participants, which in this case would mean that, quote unquote, work-capable adults between the ages of 18 and 59 would have to work at least 20 hours per week or spend an equivalent amount of time in a job training program in order to qualify for SNAP. And there are already some work requirements for SNAP in most states, but that would be an extreme expansion of the requirements. And those requirements were really strongly opposed by civil rights groups, by sustainable and local agriculture groups, by anti-hunger groups. Democrats in the House Agriculture Committee said that the work requirements would have pushed almost 2 million people off of SNAP. So that was really a non-starter for the Democrats on the Agriculture Committee.
And then there was an expansion of the farm subsidy program at a time when most people think the conversation should be about a contraction of that program.
Yes, exactly. The subsidy program is always sort of the second most controversial part of a farm bill process. And essentially, those subsidies look like direct payments and other types of subsidization of the production of certain types of crops, particularly crops that are grown on very large and industrial-style farms, such as corn and soy. And so in this farm bill, one of the stipulations around the farm subsidy program in the House proposed bill would have entitled nieces, nephews, and cousins of farm owners, in addition to immediate family of farm owners, would have entitled those relatives to up to $125,000 each in subsidy payments. So that was a big expansion in terms of who would qualify for that direct funding, and that really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
At the same time, I don't want to editorialize, but it's like at the same time this farm bill, it would be restricting the amount of help for people to buy food at the lower economic end, and then giving people additional help to not grow food at the higher end.
Yeah, that's definitely one read on it, and particularly a read that Democrats in the Ag Committee were really pushing. And, you know, to emphasize, both, you know, the SNAP program also affects people in rural areas. So the farm bill is often seen as having, you know, the quote-unquote urban element that is the SNAP program and the quote-unquote rural element that is the farm programs and the subsidies, et cetera. But there are many, many rural people who are enrolled in SNAP. And so it was really almost a 1-2 punch to some rural advocates to have both SNAP cuts and these farm subsidy expansions in the same bill.
I'm curious, what was the White House's position on the bill?
Well, President Trump expressed support for the Republican version of the bill, including work requirements, and has said that, quote, welfare reform is an important part of passing the farm bill. He hasn't said too much beyond that around specific policy.
So now we're back to square one, it seems. What's the next step?
So Congress is back in session until on June 4th, and they have about 8 weeks until the summer recess. And so today the reporting was that late June is when they're hoping to have a revote on their version of the bill, and I would imagine there would be amendments to it in the meantime. And then the Senate Agriculture Committee is also working on their version of the bill. The leaders of the Agriculture Committee, Pat Roberts and Debbie Stabenow, have said that they're really committed to a bipartisan process, so they could advance their bill while the House is still rewriting their failed bill. And it looks like early June is the time when we can see the markup process for the Senate Ag Committee.
Do you think these two controversial areas of the SNAP part of the bill and the subsidy will reappear in the House bill?
I think it certainly will. Both Mike Conaway and Paul Ryan on the Republican side have really hitched their wagon to the work requirements in particular. So it seems like unless there's, you know, sort of a sea change in the debate, that this will come up again. The subsidies as well have been pretty central to what the Republican Ag Committee members have pushed for essential building blocks of this next farm bill. So it is likely that we'll see continued debate around them.
So for all of us who do not live in Washington, why should we all be paying attention to what's happening with the farm bill?
Well, the farm bill is a huge, expensive, a very influential piece of legislation that only comes up every 5 years-ish. And it really does affect everyone. It affects absolutely people who engage with any type of public nutrition program, whether it's SNAP or WIC or school lunch programs. But also it affects the fundamental agriculture economy that we all participate in every day when we shop and eat, when we go to our farmers market, when we vote for representatives who are invested one way or another in these agriculture issues. All of that has its root in the farm bill. So it really affects everyone in the country, regardless of how much you see yourself as is particularly, you know, invested in agriculture per se, the bill is so sweeping and expansive that I really encourage folks to look into it and understand the many ripple effects that it has on everyone who is eating and shopping in the U.S.
Thank you so much, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me back.
That's Leah Douglas, staff writer and associate editor for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. We've been talking about the farm bill that failed to pass in the House last week and what to look for next. Continuing our focus on farmers, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I don't know if anybody realized that May is avocado month. According to Mark Peel, who I'm talking with today, who's an expert on many things, including avocados, which I guess we're going to talk about today. Mark Peel is the chef owner of Prawn in two locations. It's a fast casual restaurant. The first one opened down in Grand Central Market, and there's another one open now in Old Town Pasadena. Mark has been on the restaurant scene for ages, beginning with Campanile. Before that, it was Alice Waters. I mean, on and on and on.
And Chinois and Michaels. And,
oh, my goodness. And here he is today at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where all chefs wind up anyway. And here we are talking about...
All chefs congregate.
All
right
chefs
here.
Congregate. So, Mark, you're talking about avocados.
Yes.
Tell us everything.
Now, I'm not sure why May is avocado month, because you can get avocados year-round. Somebody decided. But, I mean, I love avocados. Avocados are great. The biggest variety is the Haas avocado. I love the story about the Haas avocados. You know, it was discovered locally. It was decades ago. I talked to a farmer last night, and I finally got the story straight. So the Haas avocado was discovered in La Habra by a mailman who had this small grove in La Habra, lived in Whittier, and just serendipitously, this avocado appeared on one of his trees, and his kids said, "Hey, this is a good avocado." And he said, "Yeah, it's good," and took it to a nurseryman. They started propagating it, and it's become the big kahuna in the avocado world. And it just showed up.
Right. It's
And the name of the mailman was Haas.
Oh, is that how it got
its
name?
That's his last name.
From La Habra. Do you know what year that was?
No.
Oh, okay.
A long time ago.
Why bother a good story with facts?
No, it's a fact. I talked to the farmer.
That's amazing. Yeah. So avocados grow in California. We do have seasons here. I know at a certain time of the year, we are getting some imports. So if you're not getting your avocados at the farmer's market and you're in a grocery store, do check the country of origin and do try to pick those California avocados.
This is the perfect environment here. Mm-hmm. And there's also another one, which is the Fuerte. The Fuerte, I actually like a little bit better. It's creamier and really silken. The Haas, however, dominates the market because of that pebbly, thick skin.
So it makes it shippable.
Mm-hmm. There's no point in shipping an avocado to New York if it's ruined when it gets there.
Right. And you talk about the Fuerte. Now, our avocado farmers all follow a very strict maturity release date. The avocados must develop oil on the tree before they're picked. So there is an annual release date and all the farmers follow it. So when you get an avocado here at the market, you know that it has sufficient oil that it will get that creamy, buttery taste that everybody loves.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Thank you.
Yep. And the ag department follows it. And so the Fuerte, you talk about the black pebbly skin on the Haas, and the Fuerte is more of, they call it a smooth skin or a green skin.
It's a thinner skin, yes.
Yeah, they probably don't last as long and probably don't store as well. So what avocado are you using and what recipe are we talking about?
Well, I am using the Haas because it does last a little bit longer, and we're doing an avocado soup. It's actually quite simple. We make our own yogurt. It's taking milk and bringing it up to 180 degrees, then chilling it down to 100 degrees and inoculate it with a really good whole milk yogurt culture, and then you have to let it sit overnight at room temperature, and then the following day, you have yogurt. And it's delicious. And then to make the soup, what we do is we take the yogurt and we add cucumber, a puree of the cucumber skin with some parsley and some mint, and we press the juice into it and puree that into it, and then little diced cucumbers, and we take avocado and we puree that and we swirl that into the yogurt, and it makes a soup. So it's never cooked. It's raw because you don't want to cook avocados. It's wonderful, chilled. It's a perfect summer dish.
So for Prawn, which is kind of a fast casual, you were telling us, so this is the kind of thing that you're just preparing every day, all day?
Yes. This is actually, Prawn is something I've wanted to do for decades. Yeah, it's easy to make really good food for $100 per person, but our average check is about $15. That's a little more difficult. That takes some skill and focus and passion, but that's where people are. And that's where I can take the knowledge that I have from the years in fine dining mm-hmm. and apply it to this mm-hmm. and bring it to people where they live. The idea is to pare away everything that's not food.
That was Mark Peel, and he is chef owner of Prawn Restaurants. There's two, Grand Central Market and Old Town Pasadena. Mark is celebrating the season with us at the market. I'm talking now with Margarita Smith, who is with Mud Creek Ranch from Santa Paula. And they come down to the Wednesday market every week. Steve Smith, her dad, and Robin, her mom, grow just an astounding variety of fruit, including a lot of kinds of avocados. For example, on your table, you've got about 5 varieties of avocados. How many do you grow, and are these in season right now?
Altogether, the varieties that we grow, it probably adds up to about 25 to 30 different varieties of avocados that we have. There's the winter avocados that you harvest them in the wintertime. There's summer, there's late summer, there's spring, which allows you to have avocados almost all year round. Besides just Haas, which is the mass production, grocery store, easy shipping.
Mm-hmm. Hides all the bruises.
Hides all the bruises, yeah.
See them. Yeah. All right, so today, for example, Mark Peel, who we talked to, was mentioning the Fuerte. Do you have a favorite avocado?
I do, and Fuerte actually is my favorite as well. And Fuerte was the original big grocery store shipping avocado forever before the Haas was discovered, just because it did ship really well. And the flavor of it is incredible. High oil content, rich nutty. It's slightly less oil than a Haas, so it actually, the shelf life is better.
Right. And for your avocados, they stay on the tree until they're picked for market. It's not a crop that is picked and then stored, is it? It's just out there on the orchard, just getting better and better.
I mean, we pick them before the market, but avocados actually don't, they ripen off the tree, they don't ripen on the tree, so you kind of pick them ahead of time if you want them to be softer, but it depends what, you know, the application, whether you're going to sell them to a packing house or they're for the farmer's market and you want to have like some not ready and some ripe.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the oil content, because I know that there is this very strict release schedule and they do have to develop enough oil. So how do you know when to pick? Do you go by that schedule, or can you go out to the orchard and just tell if they're the right size, they're okay to pick, you can just assume they have developed enough oil?
It's a little bit of both. We definitely follow that schedule to a certain extent, but also, you know, we grow a lot of heirloom varieties, and some of them are just like, you know, one tree of this, one tree of that. And you kind of have an idea of like the gauge of when it's ripens throughout the year. It's like one of those things, like you just kind of look at the fruit and it kind of tells you like, pick me, and then you pick it.
The fruit talks to you. Is that what you're saying?
All the time. Are you kidding?
All the time.
It's love.
And I had no idea there were 25 different varieties of avocados in existence.
And that's what we have at Mud Creek. That like scratches the surface of avocado varieties that exist in the world.
That was Margarita Smith, and she's the farmer's daughter. Her mom and dad, Robin and Steve, grow so many varieties of avocados. They grow so many varieties of tangerine citrus. It's always fun to stop by their stand and have a visit with one of the workers here. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Ramadan is underway. Coming up, a timely conversation with London-based author Anissa Helou about the foods of the Islamic world. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
And the Prophet Muhammad broke his fast every day, supposedly, allegedly, with 3 dates.
That's London-based food writer Anissa Helou. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan is underway, and she's been talking with me about foods that are eaten to break the fast. Anissa's led a fascinating life. Born to a Syrian father and a Lebanese mother, she was raised in Beirut, studied in London, and ended up traveling the Middle East as a rep for Sotheby's. Along the way, her attention turned to food. She's written seminal cookbooks, including titles like Lebanese Cuisine and Mediterranean Street Food. Anissa's newest book is called Feast. It's an expansive look at food of the Islamic world that goes way beyond the usual suspects like hummus. The bread chapter alone is an incredible study. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
You know, it's been really fascinating following you on social media as you've been doing research for this book and then getting the book. It's just gorgeous.
I'm so glad you like it. And it was actually totally fascinating researching the book and writing it. And even though I knew parts of it, it was very fresh to kind of start again with a different angle and to look at it from, you know, a general angle of the food of the Islamic world as against only national dishes.
How much of what we look at and see as being food of the Islamic world is related to the Persian Empire?
Well, a lot of it. There are basically two mother cuisines for that world. One is the Persian Empire and the other is the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire actually descends from the Persian Empire. So the mother cuisine is the cuisine of the Persian Empire, which was basically appropriated. I know it's a loaded word, but, you know, the Abbasid caliphs took Persian cooks because they loved the cuisine and they were much more refined than they were and took them everywhere where they invaded and occupied. And then when the Ottoman Empire came along, they developed their own, but the basis being, you know, Persian dishes.
In terms of what you present that aren't breads in this book, how much of it comes from court food or royal food, maybe I should say, as opposed to a tradition of home cooking?
I think there's a good balance between court dishes and home cooked dishes. There is very little that is basically a restaurant. But, you know, in most of this world, home cooking is much more interesting, basically, and better than in the restaurants. I mean, if you go to Iran, for instance, it's unlikely that you're going to eat consistently well in restaurants. The best food you're going to have will be home cooked food. Whereas in Lebanon, you would have different dishes at home and really excellent dishes, but you can also have fantastic experiences in restaurants, basically because of the mezeh tradition.
I would love to talk to you about bread. The bread chapter, which opens the book, is just an incredible introduction to the variety and the minuscule variation as you go from country to country.
Well, bread is so essential to, I mean, there are two staples in the Muslim world. One is bread and the other is rice. Some countries have both as staples and others have one or the other. And so bread is essential in many countries, like in Lebanon and Syria. Also, it acts as cutlery because they scoop the food with bread. So I felt that it was a very important chapter.
We're in Ramadan right now, and you have a recipe for Ramadan bread that also includes dates, which are important in Ramadan. Could you talk about the date and also that particular bread?
The Prophet Muhammad was born and lived in an oasis where the date was very, very important. It was not only a fruit to be, you know, to sustain, but also bartering because it could be sold and exchanged. And the Prophet Muhammad broke his fast every day, supposedly, allegedly, with three dates. And then in Syria and in Lebanon, they make these beautiful type of like brioche bread filled with dates. It's basically a snack, not quite as sweet and not a bread to serve with meals, but to snack on.
The history of bread is often pointed to Egypt and, in fact, the history of yeast and the leavening process. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, apparently it was discovered by chance because the bakeries were near the beer makers and the yeast was in the air and they, you know, they left a piece of dough and it kind of rose and they found that it was much lighter and much nicer to, you know, to eat. So they started developing it like this. And they're still, like in Kashgar in China, they still keep a piece of dough from the previous dough and they, you know, they mix it with the new dough. A lot of the breads are not particularly leavened because flat breads don't need that much leavening. But, you know, you need the dough to ferment to get a good flavor and to get texture as well.
So if you were not on book tour, traveling from place to place, and you were going to create a festive table for breaking the fast at the end of the day, what would you have on it from this book?
I have a particular weakness for a recipe for the whole goat roast that I learned to make in the Emirates, because the marinade is so extraordinary, you know, with rose water and saffron and a whole collection of spices. So I often make that, not as, I mean, in Sicily, where I spend a lot of time, I roast baby lamb because I can buy very small lambs. But often I would do it with a shoulder or with a leg. And then the Emirati biryani, which is plain rice that's layered with a very concentrated sauce, spicy sauce as well, made with peppers, tomatoes, and onions. Probably a bread, or I could probably break the fast with mansaf, which is the national dish of Jordan. Lamb that is cooked in yogurt and served over a bed of rice on a flat bread.
There's this marvelous sort of side story in the book all about your search for a camel hump. Is camel a meat that is common in parts of the Islamic world?
It is common enough from the point of view that in Syria or in Morocco there are camel, or in Egypt for that matter, you have camel butchers and you can buy it. But old camel is not particularly good because it's quite tough. You know, my search was for the ultimate camel hump, and from a baby camel. So baby camel is what's precious. And in the Arabian Gulf, you don't buy a camel hump or a camel leg. You buy a whole camel. And I was lucky enough that a friend of mine gave me as a present a whole baby camel.
Could you describe what that meat is like?
It was really tender. First of all, the camel hump, it's a lot of fat. But under that hump, there are two fillets against the spine of the animal. And that bit of meat is very tender and very delicious. And so when I cooked the camel hump for my brother in Dubai, he lives in Dubai, first of all, he thought I was crazy when he saw what I brought into his kitchen. And then when I served it to him with saffron rice, he was surprised how good it was. So it's like a cross between beef and lamb. It's not as strong tasting as lamb, and it's not as meaty as beef.
So the breadth of this book is sort of extraordinary. As you've been traveling with it, have people focused in on one dish or another that you think is going to sort of rise to the top as one that is going to be made and blogged about quite a bit?
I would think that if they're going to concentrate on dishes, they would concentrate on less on dishes that they're less familiar with, that other cookbooks have not covered. And one area that hasn't been covered much is the Arabian Gulf, particularly in the West. So they might, I mean, and there is a whole section in the rice chapter on biryani. So maybe biryani could be the dish that people will search to perfect and make and succeed with.
And the spices, the spice bases for most of these biryanis, what are they like? Are they something in between a curry and something more sweet like ras el hanout from Morocco?
Some are quite heady. You know, like the Arabian spice mix, bzar, is quite heady. I think there is a bit of everything. And some are very, very simple. The Tunisian bharat, for instance, is just dried rose petals and cinnamon. It's very fragrant and very light. I mean, I was very interested in having all these spice mixtures because usually people concentrate on one or two. But there are so many and such a variation in the kind of flavor that they impart. You know, if it's very complex, if it's simple, if it's really heady, if it's sweet, if it's spicy, you know. So even in the garam masala, I give like three different versions to kind of change, you know, the flavor marginally, but enough to notice the difference. So I mean, probably not so much like a curry, because the curry has, maybe I don't know enough about curry, but it has a strong turmeric presence, whereas these turmeric is present in a lot of them, but they're quite balanced, even if they're heady and strong.
So as I've been watching you live your life from afar, as we do now, I was so intrigued that you decided to create a home for yourself in Sicily. Could you talk a bit about why Sicily, why it feels like such a familiar place for you?
Well, I went to Sicily for the first time in 20 years ago, to the eastern part, I think, to a beautiful place south of Noto. And I was so struck by how similar the landscape was to parts of Syria. And of course, it's a very beautiful island and surrounded by the sea. And I was brought up in Beirut, which was a seaside city. So that these two things kind of appealed very much to me. And then I went back and I traveled more. But 10 years later, I went back to stay with Mary Taylor Simeti for the olive harvest on her farm. And it kind of brought back all those summers in Syria that I spent with my aunt, where we had everything brought to us from the farm, I mean, from her farm and or cousins, because we lived in a place that was only family. I just thought, this is like going home without going home. You know, the Middle East is in turmoil. Lebanon had had its civil war. I was thinking about leaving London, but I wanted to go somewhere beautiful and sunny because London is beautiful, but not particularly sunny. And Sicily was the perfect place.
That's Anissa Helou. Her latest cookbook is Feast, Food of the Islamic World. Find a recipe from her book on the Good Food blog. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Street vending was recently legalized here in Los Angeles, but for many vendors, getting a permit isn't so cut and dry. Look at the hurdles some are facing when Good Food continues. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. After 5 years of debate, the LA City Council finally approved a plan last month to regulate sidewalk vending. Now city officials are writing an ordinance that will let street vendors, including food carts, sell their wares. But it's not exactly a done deal. Many of the 50,000 vendors in LA are not the fancy hot dog carts with a line around the block. They're a mishmash of neighborhood stands selling things like trinkets, used electronics, secondhand goods, in addition to all kinds of food. And writing one ordinance that applies to them all, well, it's not going to be easy. Earlier this week, Morning Edition host Cherry Glazer sat down with Daniel Hernandez, editor of LA Taco. Daniel's been speaking with sidewalk vendors about their business realities. Here's Cherry.
So, you know, we often think of that hot dog cart outside a popular bar or selling merchandise, you know, mementos, tourist stuff on Hollywood Boulevard. But there are a lot of vendors that are very far from these sort of tourism hotspots. You spent some time around a swap meet in South Central LA recently. What was it like?
Well, yeah, I mean, once you get out of Hollywood and downtown, street vending becomes a job of necessity for many people. People are trying to cobble together an income, and so they're selling really whatever they can get their hands on. And that ranges from prepared foods to unprepared foods, secondhand goods, clothing, secondhand electronics, stuff that people discard, you know, in our kind of consumer society, I guess. And the vendors are putting together their lives in whatever the way they can. And those are the vendors, I think, that are most vulnerable and have really the most challenges moving forward as we decide as a city how to legalize them.
So in some ways, it sounds like these vendors are really sort of a second economy, you know, separate from what we think of as sort of traditional stores or online merchants or what have you.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, for example, MacArthur Park and the community that has generated around it, ranging from Central American migration to today, there's a lot of vending there. And what the city wants to do, they want to, as they legalize it, separate vendors and only allow two per block. Well, that's really kind of functionally impossible if you take a look at how things are sort of already working on the street. Some areas have more vendors. Some areas obviously don't need them, like Century City or parts around here on the west side and so on. But there, specifically in South Central Main Street, for about the past 15 years, there's been a sort of organic, unofficial swap meet that feels very much like the kind of mercado tianguis, if you will, that you might find in Mexico or Central America. And that's where many of these vendors congregate. Sometimes it only happens on the weekends, the vending. Usually they congregate around churches, around sort of transit stops, the typical kind of vending that you see in many places south of the border, right? So this particular swap meet gets together only on the weekends. And one man that I met, Humberto Yauli, a Peruvian immigrant, he sells just used stuff, mm-hmm. you know, and he uses whatever money that he can get from this vending to augment his very limited income here in LA. Tools, old DVDs, old VHS tapes even, you know, things like Dodgers mementos and sort of coffee mugs, anything like that. And he, I mean, I can't imagine him making more than $100 a day on this kind of bending.
Now, is he able to support a family, cover his basics with this?
Well, it's a very good question. I don't think, based on the reporting that I've done, that the vendors consider this work sort of their full-time life. Many may and many might, right? But for other people, they're doing all kinds of other work. Humberto Yauli, for example, the man that I really got to know, also does sort of very weird, odd jobs like, you know, babysitting a used car lot or, you know, random construction gigs. So they're really trying to cobble together a life and preventing themselves from becoming, let's say, homeless or unhoused or unsheltered. He, I think, symbolizes this a group of largely unseen vendors who really are very vulnerable, and not only on the margins of the economy, but also on the margins of the housing crisis that we have in the city, and also extremely vulnerable, I think, to crime, to petty crime. And so all of these things make these vendors extremely vulnerable.
And then they also run into pressure from brick-and-mortar retailers. You know, what are some of the issues that they're hearing about from conventional merchants? What are the complaints from conventional merchants?
Right. So brick-and-mortar businesses frequently will complain to city officials that street vending either deters customers from entering their business because there's just too much traffic on the sidewalk, or actually take a business away from them. So I asked Mr. Yauli what his response was to that, and this is what he said.
We are not their rivals. On the contrary, if we don't have something someone is looking for, we send them to the businesses. We're not sending them to Walmart or Target. We tell them to go to the closest little store.
He sees himself as sort of a step or an element of the overall economy. And I think that that sort of reasoning is what has been pushing these vendors very much to push the city to legalize them and to decriminalize their work so that they can, you know, sell in peace, basically.
Mm-hmm. What does Humberto think about the negotiations going on now in the city council to regulate street vending? Does he think this is going to make his life easier, or does he think he'll have other issues to worry about?
Yeah, well, as we've reported on LA Taco for a while now, vendors are quite skeptical. They've been waiting for this for years. Every few months, there's an incremental step. A city council committee will send the resolution to the full city council. The city council then directs the city attorney to draw up an ordinance. And through that whole process, which takes months and months and months, there's so many stakeholders that need to be involved and need a seat at that table, from the business community to the police department to county health inspectors. So they're just waiting. And I would say that they've been waiting very patiently in order to get to a point where they don't have to worry about regulators or the police coming and confiscating their stuff. The actual nitty-gritty work of organizing and of advocating for their positions is done by the vendors themselves. And that's what I find very impressive. You know, in addition to what's happening here in the city, they're also now lobbying up in Sacramento. And, you know, there is a state initiative to legalize street vendors statewide here in the state of California, which would be, I think, incredibly revolutionary for the kinds of questions and issues we have of what kind of a city do we want, how do we want our city to feel, and how do we want it to reflect the realities of immigration and of demographic shifts that have occurred, you know, in the past 20 years here in Los Angeles.
Our thanks to Morning Edition host Cherry Glazer. She spoke with Daniel Hernandez of LA Taco earlier this week about the challenges facing sidewalk vendors. Now for a visit with Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold.
It was one of the most extraordinary experiences I've ever had.
Today, Jonathan's taking us a little farther afield than usual. Jonathan, a lot of us have been following your, may we say, peripatetic travels lately. You seem to be in a different far-flung locale every week these days. Most recently, Tokyo.
Yeah, Tokyo was fun.
How could Tokyo not be fun? Where was the focus of your fun in Tokyo this time around?
Well, I went there specifically to go to a restaurant called Narasawa, whose chef came to Los Angeles to be part of Food Bowl. I thought I should probably experience in its native habitat before I, you know, talk to the chef on stage.
So tell us a bit about him.
Narasawa grew up in the countryside. He went all around Europe, staging in some of the most famous French restaurants, and came back to make a career in Japan. He first started in the area that he grew up in, and he moved a long time ago to Tokyo, where he's in, it's sort of like stuck behind an office building in a part of town you wouldn't expect to find great dining, but that's where a lot of the best places in Tokyo tend to be anyway.
Is he a specialist in one particular area of food, or is he providing a tasting menu that sort of covers a lot of ground?
He is not what you would call a purist Japanese chef, though he has the level of obsessiveness. And there's obviously a lot of elements of Western cuisine in what he does. And he is very much a friend of the most advanced kitchen technology. I mean, there are rotovaps and centrifuges and sous vide and like all kinds of that stuff shows up in his cooking. But if you want to understand why he is so revered, and he was named the best chef in Asia in the 50 best competition this year, it's probably a dish that he has always on his menu called Sadayama scenery, which is like 7 square inches or whatever of edible forest floor. There are things made out of yogurt that he makes from soybeans that are dried and then dyed with matcha to look like mosses and dirt. There is a scattering of cherry blossoms, or at least there was when I was there, was the heart of cherry blossom season. There were like rough cylinders of rolled fishkin and roots transformed into what looked like fallen twigs. Then there's fish and there's creamy soy yogurt, almost more things than you can describe, like assembled on a slice of raw log, the outside of the log with the bark on it that can't be commercially used. You start with this wooden jigger brimming with a cold essence of oak and some other tree. It's basically tree-flavored water. It's the closest you'll ever come in life to drinking a tree. Up above the plate is this cloudy glass plate that looks like a mountain pool or something. And there are 3 ayu or a sweet fish that have been quickly deep-fried when they're alive, I've heard. And they actually look like the kind of woodblock paintings that you would see in, you know, the national museums. It looks like something out of 19th century Japan. And you have this tableau, and you're eating it, and you're looking at it, and you're smelling it. And apparently, in some iterations of it, there's speakers installed with a direct line to a part of the forest so you can, like, listen to the forest.
Did you just fly to eat at this one meal and fly back, or did you have any other great experiences?
I had the great, like, you know, ramen and going to a wonderful soba restaurant and being thrown out of a yakitori restaurant because I didn't speak Japanese. But I think the other meal that stunned me, maybe even more, was this place called Sushi Kimura, a very small sushi bar in a sort of Orange County-like suburb. I had sort of imagined it being in a place like Cudahy or Norwalk, and it was like as if it were in the shadow of the South Coast Plaza, that kind of neighborhood. And the Chef Kimura specializes in aging fish, and the fish on his menus varies between age 5 days. I think the sea urchin is aged only 5 days.
So this is really fascinating because it isn't like dry-aged beef, something that we're used to hearing happening a lot. Although I expect if you think about fermented fish, then that in a way is aged. So is this salted?
Some of it is salted. Some of it is a little soy. There's kombu places. Sushi originated as a form of preservation, that being slightly vinegared and topped with seaweed and pressed into vinegared rice, it could last a couple days, which is much longer than an oily fish like, you know, mackerel, which is the original sushi fish people think. So this is almost an extreme version of that, although he doesn't age it on rice itself. Most famous one, I guess, is the swordfish that has been aged for 55 days. It was my favorite of them. It was the one he's best known for. And in its aging process, it develops a flavor almost like coffee.
Wow. So kind of like natto.
I would say it's more evocative than natto, but we've always had an argument about, you know, super fermented soybeans to begin with.
Does he only do this kind of extreme aged sushi, or does he also do something that's more recognizable to most of us?
It's a small restaurant. It's what he does. He uses other techniques in addition to that. I mean, he will like spot smoke things in really subtle ways. So you won't even know it's smoky, and then suddenly the smokiness will just like appeared almost like a delayed reaction. And he does this thing where he will like actually like bake fugu a little bit. Fugu is a very mild, chewy fish, and this comes across as a pungent fish.
Was there one thing that just blew you away the most?
Yeah, there was. He took crab and he marinated and like homemade soy sauce for many, many, many days. And it came out and it looked like the Korean dish gejang gejang, which is one of my very favorite Korean things. It's like a marinated raw blue crab. And this was taking something that I already loved and almost making it like exponentially more flavorful. It was just almost explosive in its effect. You know, it was gooey, it was salty, and the umami just sort of like blasted.
Well, I for one am certainly glad that you've traveled so you could bring us back news of these really interesting places. Thank you, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and we've been talking about his recent trip to Japan and the restaurant Narisawa. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on your phone. After the break, we're talking about flexi-discs and their relationship with the food industry. If you don't remember what those are, we'll fill you in. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Before we close, I want to tell you about a podcast from KCRW that I love. It's called Lost Notes, and it's this 8-part series about the greatest music stories never told. I'm talking to food writer and filmmaker Richard Parks III about his episode that just came out called $1 Million Worth of Plastic. It's about an interesting piece of technology called a flexi-disc. Some of you might remember what that is. Richard traveled to Galax, Virginia to learn more about this odd pop culture artifact and what it has to do with food. I know what a flexi-disc is.
Because you were born before...
Because I'm hashtag old.
So yeah, at one point, I mean, the Beatles would record a new Christmas song for their fan club every year. I don't know if you remember.
This is George Harrison saying, Happy Christmas, Happy Christmas, 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 happy, happy.
Oh, good evening to you, Jesus.
Before we get deep into this, you should describe exactly what this medium is, because it's very odd.
It is anything that is thinner than your typical vinyl record, or it's a piece of paper that's coated thinly with vinyl that is smaller than a 45, often flexible, thus flexi-disc, that you can rip out of a magazine or an instructional book and put on your turntable and play.
I'm just curious, did they create these because it was cheaper to mail, because they were less heavy?
Absolutely. So, I mean, flexi-discs come in all shapes and sizes. Often they were postcards that you could literally put through the mail. In fact, I have one for you here.
Oh, thank you.
That is a FlexiDisc.
It's a Gorilla Taco FlexiDisc. You, of course, are the co-author with Chef Wesley Avila of the Gorilla Taco Cookbook.
Right. So I had no idea that there was this strong connection between food and Flexis until late last year when it came time to promote this book that I wrote with Wesley Avila of Gorilla Tacos. And we were on a conference call with the publisher, and they were like, we have this pot of money. You can do some promotional stuff. People like to do pins. I was like, temporary tattoos, because I thought that was crazy. And they're like, yeah, people have done that, but sure, you can do that. And Wes was like, he's a guy who grew up eating lots of fast food. And he was like, as an homage to 80s fast food, we should do a FlexiDisc, like the ones that used to come in Burger King's kids' meals. And I was like, what are you talking about? But it turns out that in the 80s, at some point, every single kids' meal you got from Burger King would come with one of five FlexiDiscs with recordings by Alf, the fictional television personality from that era, doing hilarious songs like Melmac Girls, which is sort of like a send-up of a Beach Boys-esque kind of song.
Those girls, those Melmac girls, they're out of this world.
They were often on cereal boxes.
Absolutely. Well, so fast food's association with the Flexi seems to have peaked in the 80s, but in the 70s, it was all about cereal. So, like, for example, you could get an Archie's comic skit on the back of your Sugar Pop cereal box. You could rip that off and put it on your turntable and play a comic skit.
And incur the wrath of your parents.
Absolutely.
Forevermore for ruining the needle.
Well, your parents deserve it if they allowed you to eat Sugar Pops, even in the 70s. Come on, folks. But yeah, there's a lot more cereal promotions. For example, there was a custom line of FlexiDisc records that came on the back of cereal boxes called Kiss Crunch by the band Kiss, K-I-S-S. And the Post cereals did a lot with the Monkees back catalog and then the Jackson 5.
So for me, the most interesting food-related FlexiDisc has to be in the McDonald's Million Dollar one, because it's such a strange thing for them to do. And then the way it played out with the winner is just everything you want in a story, you know?
Right.
Hope, tragedy.
Oh, geez. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that it is everything you wanted in a story, Evan. That makes me very happy and proud. But, I mean, typical McDonald's, right? Not to be outdone by their rival Burger King, who at the time was doing the Alf thing. In the late 80s, McDonald's got into Flexis in a huge way and really, like, upped the ante by printing 80 million Flexis in one go. The corporate excess of that is insane, because 80 million is the equivalent of, at the time, an 80 times platinum record, back when people bought records. And so, like, by comparison, the Eagles' Greatest Hits, which is the second best-selling album of all time, sold 29 million. Michael Jackson's Thriller sold 66 million, 80 million. And I like to say, if you're the type that finds peaceful, easy feeling a little cloying, then you have to hear the track that was on this McDonald's Flexi.
It's so unbelievable of its time. Was this a game that McDonald was trying to encourage everyone to join in?
This was a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory style contest. 79,999,999 of these Flexi discs, one track was played. It was the McDonald's menu song being learned by a class, is the conceit of the recording. And so the McDonald's menu song name checks every item on the McDonald's menu, which even in 1989 was a lot of stuff.
Here goes.
Here goes.
Big Mac, McDLT, a quarter pounder with some cheese filet, a fish, a hamburger, a cheeseburger, a Happy Meal, McNuggets, tasty golden french fries, regular or larger size, a salad, chef or garden, or a chicken salad, oriental, big breakfast, egg McMuffin, hot hotcakes and sausage, maybe biscuits, bacon, egg and cheese or sausage.
And what was on that one, the 80 millionth one?
So the one in 80 million record, which, as far as I can tell, is the rarest record you could possibly hope to find. On this track, the class learned the song correctly, finished singing it, every item in the McDonald's menu, and at the end, apparently, it says, you've won. Call this number. And that record entitled whoever found it to $1 million.
Which then was $1 million.
Right. We're talking about $1 million when a million meant something.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, still a lot of money. But in Galax, Virginia, this sort of modest Appalachian town where a lot of American furniture was made back in, you know, the twilight of that era, right before NAFTA. In fact, Scotty Landreth, my main character who found this record, found it the exact same year that NAFTA was enacted, which is when all the jobs left Galax, Virginia. But $1 million would go far anywhere, but certainly in a place like Galax, Virginia, it's just known for this annual fiddle competition and is a place where it's, you know, it's kind of hard to find good work.
What's really interesting to me about this particular FlexiDisc is if I had one, I don't even know that I would listen through to the very end.
Right. So there's this kid, Scotty Landreth, and he's home alone from school, and it's a winter day in Galax, Virginia, and he needs to start a fire to warm himself up in the family's wood stove, which is what heats the house. It's also where they cook their cornbread and vegetables from the garden, squirrels that would be hunted in the hills around. And he sees this little flash of black plastic in the burn box, which is where he finds kindling for the fire. And he gets excited because this is the first record this guy has ever owned. He has a record player, an old AM-FM record player combination that he got as a gift for Christmas, but he hasn't played a record on it because he just doesn't come for much. There aren't records around in the house. So that's why he takes it out of the burn box, saves it from the fire, and puts it on his record player and plays the first record of his life. And so, of course, he listens all the way through. Plus, you can't fit that much music on a Flexi. This is sort of a low-quality affair. You have to get through it in, you know, under 3 minutes, probably. And at the end, it says, call this number. You've won.
And was there a phone in the house for him to make that call?
They did have a phone, yes. But he didn't know what he had won. He thought maybe he had won free meals, and that would have been good with him. That would have been something. Lifelong McDonald's fan. But what he actually won was $1 million. And of course, we hear a lot about these sort of contest stories and lotto stories, and things don't often work out well. And that's certainly the case here. You know, by the time I followed up on this story nearly 3 decades later, the money was long gone. Scotty's mother, who actually accepted the winnings because Scotty was a minor, she was long since dead. But things had gone wrong in a way that maybe you wouldn't expect. And I'd say it's like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but in Appalachia with McDonald's and much darker.
Well, there you have it, KCRW's Lost Notes.
Check it out where you pod.
That's Richard Parks III. Check out his fascinating episode for KCRW's Lost Notes podcast wherever you get your shows. It's called $1 Million Worth of Plastic. That's it for this week's Good Food. Before we go, I want to invite those of you who are in New York to a very special event. On Tuesday, June 12th, the Sporkful podcast is holding a live taping at the Caveat called the Bucatini Dialogues. Sporkful host Dan Pashman will moderate a debate with me and Francis Lamb of the Splendid Table about a highly emotional topic, pasta shapes. We'll be tackling major controversies such as spaghetti versus fettuccine, or are bow ties magical or awful? It's an evening of food science, history, and inflamed passions. Good Food is co-presenting this event with the Sporkful and the Splendid Table, and it's the very first time we've joined forces. I'm really excited about it. So please come and be part of history on June 12th. Tickets are $15. Visit caveat.nyc for tickets and info. That's all I got. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and remember to leave us a little review if you like the show. It helps a lot. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I am Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.